The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. As we head into hour two, it is a delight to bring back our Congressman David Schweiker, representing Arizona's Congressional District 1. David, how are you?
You know, I'm fine. I'm actually in one of the phone booths and back of the floor, though they're in recess, but it was the closest landline I could find, and I have a little girl with me, so I have my 7-year-old with me.
Well, that's great. I guess she's getting a Schoolhouse Rock education directly, as opposed to the way we got it on the television.
Yeah, sort of like that. It is sort of fun, though, because she, you know, has been coming with me to Washington since she was, you know, tiny. And so she's actually quite comfortable. So she just ran off to go say hi to one of the clerks who's, like she says, her friend. So,
all right, buddy. What's going on? What do we need to know?
Be careful out there. I think we have some trolls that are putting out some pretty disingenuous information on, you know, the budget portion or spending cap portion of this debt ceiling deal. You never get what you wanted, but a lot of folks, you know, don't seem to process. We control the House by functionally 5 votes. We don't control the Senate. We don't control the White House. So it's pretty remarkable that, depending on how things go this evening, we may actually have the largest rescission and budget cut in U.S. history. Now, there's a number of gimmicks in it. So, you know, I believe the real number is only about $1.5 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
Not because to get to the $2.1 trillion over the 10-year cycle. Everything has to fall perfectly in place, and there can't be any cheating. And this place cheats. The White House cheats.
Mm-hmm.
But the hard number, you know, without, you know, which is sort of locked in, is at least the $1.5 trillion. So it's not what we need, but it's a start. The problem is it's all in discretionary. And, you know, it's just so hard to explain to people. In 9 years, you can get rid of every dime of discretionary, including defense, and you still have to borrow hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars just to have enough cash to cover Medicare.
David, at the end of the voting, do you think it'll be resolved by the end of the evening tonight? We'll have a clear vote on it by the end of the evening tonight. At the end of it, do you think more Republicans will be voting for it or more Democrats?
Oh, yes. Yeah. No. The vast majority of Republicans will vote for it.
And the vast majority of Democrats?
No. I think we'll get 60 Dems, something like that.
Shouldn't that tell us something?
There's more to it. What's disappointing is you always have some folks who are raising money on big votes like this. I mean, if you're getting text messages from someone or emails saying this is horrible or this is wonderful, send me money, it's actually about the money. Look, the Dems are incredibly angry that they negotiated at all, and a number of us on the Republican side, we desperately wanted more. But this is what you call a stressor. And you got to be careful because you're walking this weird tightrope where we probably have 15, 20 Republicans that if this got right up against the last second, they'd walk over and vote with the Democrats for what they call a clean debt ceiling, a debt ceiling with no requirements of spending cuts at all. So, you know, you're doing this sort of dance of how far can you push before the House of Cards falls in on you.
And then finally, I think it's worth pointing out, too, what happens if we don't get an agreement.
It gets ugly. What I believe really would happen is, if let's say the vote fell tonight, you'd probably see a dozen, maybe 20, Republicans just walk over, sign the discharge petition the Democrats have, and the Democrats would get what they want. So we're not going to let that happen. There's been just, you know, months of work put into this. But remember, it was 2 months ago, Joe Biden and the Democrats said there was no way in hell they were ever going to negotiate.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
You forget how far we dragged them.
Right.
And I mean, and they're just ripping us out there in the press gallery right now for demanding work requirements. I mean, it's just crazy how they view the world.
It is. And I think it's also interesting that the focus on this is an agreement. It's an agreement effectively between the White House and the House of Representatives. Do we have a sense of what the Senate will do?
The Senate is, there's a term called jamming.
Yeah.
That basically means, you understand this, you've been around this, you're handing them a piece of legislation, and they don't have time. They're going to do some fussing, there'll be some stalling over there, there'll be some tactics of speechifying and then fundraising on the speechifying. And then in the last moments or so, the Senate will pass it, and it's done. That is the nature of the Senate these days. They have an individual senator can stall things where an individual House member can't, because we're a rules-based body. They're an individual-based body. It's just the traditions. But, you know, the choice is what?
Well, that's kind of, if I can go back with that point in the question before, that's kind of where I was thinking this would be on, I guess, Monday and Tuesday, which was reading the way the headlines were in the papers about it, was that this looked like a Republican victory.
Yeah.
And right. And especially if you look at what the White House was saying up until Wednesday or Thursday, this looked like a Republican victory. And it seems to me that we're losing a little bit of that narrative, a little bit. The media wants us to lose that narrative. Mm-hmm. But if more Democrats, this was my point before last, if more Democrats are voting against it than Republicans, this means that that the Democrats are unhappy with this.
Oh, no, the Democrats are always angry around here.
Yes.
Look, we took them from no cuts, no work requirements, no pipeline permitting reforms, all these things that got put in here. We got those things, and when you're about to lose in politics, sometimes the smartest play is just pretend you own it.
Uh-huh.
You know, hey, this, I got what I wanted.
Yeah.
And so they're in that spin control. The problem is you also have that Democrat troll army out there.
Yeah.
Something Republicans don't have. Remember, if you see things in comment sections on blogs or articles or this and that, you be careful. Half the time, their bots are part of the Democrats' media misinformation operation.
Sure. So if we wake up tomorrow morning, what will the headline be? Assuming that the vote happens before the New York Times goes to bed.
Look, if it's mainstream media, they'll come up with some way to slam Republicans for our cruelty of asking people to work, able-bodied people to work for their benefits, or the fact we're trying to cap spending. It's just crazy the way the traditional media here in Washington spins things. And that's how it gets fed out to the rest of the country.
Some of the language from some of the dissenters within the Republican body, within the Republican Party membership, has been pretty hot. Mm-hmm. How, by next week, how serious of a threat to the leadership is this? How much memory will be on this?
I mean, you get angry because you get the expectations you can get more.
Okay.
But, you know, if you sit, like, we did something, you know, last night, we whiteboarded it.
Yeah.
Okay, you know, because sometimes, you know, it's this bill is only 99 pages. You can read it in 2 hours.
Yeah.
It's a simple read. And you lay out saying, okay, here's what we got. All right, the first 2 years are locked. The next 4 years on the caps, it's an agreement, but there's too many weasel clauses. This ties into the appropriations bills that come later today. You got to sort of think of this as sort of the setup for what's about to come.
Yeah.
Okay, this is the first step. You got a capping. you got something we call the Massey Amendment. Representative Massey's been talking about this crazy idea, which is wonderful, saying you guys don't actually do appropriate bills? Fine. When you go to do the continuing resolution, which is what the Democrats want because it's based on last year's budget, you take a 1% cut.
Uh-huh.
And that will drive them insane.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right, brother. I really appreciate you calling in.
All right. You're wonderful.
All right. Go get him. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Goodbye.
Thank you,
now.
David Schweikert. I'm Seth Leibson, 602-508-0960. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, 602-508-0960. There's this great great piece over at Tablet Magazine I wanted to share with you. Increasingly, I know that we get inundated with things that we want to read, things that people say you need to read, things that we should read. Tablet Magazine is increasingly one of them, tabletmag.org. It's smart conservatism, and I do sometimes wonder how much room there is in our constellation for more conservative outlets. This one's been around for not that long, a couple of years. I saw the New York Sun is coming back, and the good news about that is, and the good news with all these new conservative outlets coming out, is that there seemingly is a desire for them, an appetite for them, a thirst for them, a want for them. That should be telling us something good. I have to tell you, I don't see a lot of liberal journals sprouting up or growing or being created. On the other hand, they don't need to. They have all the media in the world that they could want, don't they? But anyway, this one, as I kind of am going through this ongoing study of how we're shaping children's minds, how we're shaping students' minds and changing society over time, you know, the kind of thing we all finally woke up to during COVID about what was going on in the schools. You know, people ask, how do we get here? How did we get here? How did we get to a place where executives at Target are saying the kinds of things they're saying, or the Dodgers? You know, you graduate 6 million high school and college students a year for 30 years, drenched in socialism and Marxism. This is how we get here. Now, people will say, well, they didn't all take political science courses. No, of course they didn't. But whether they're anthropology courses or sociology courses, they might even be worse, because in those fields the Marxism isn't explicit. In poli-sci, it's pretty, or government, it's pretty explicit. They tell you this is a Marxist read of things. The other fields are just totally dominated by it. And even the economics. And even if you're not a major in the social sciences, even if you're not a major or a minor in the social sciences, you're in that environment. Who are the speakers coming to campus? What are the clubs that exist on campus? How are the conservative clubs treated when they come or try to arise on campus? How are the conservative speakers treated when they come to campus? Well, we have the videos, you know. So it's not a stretch to say at least 80% of the students graduating, the 6 million in high school and college every year, are drenched in socialism and Marxism. That's how you get where we are. And even elementary school. So this article in the Tablet Magazine, I want to go through it with you a little bit. It talks about what's going on, for instance, from a teacher who used to be high-ranking union member at the teachers' union in the Oakland Education Association, which is the National Education Association affiliate in Oakland, California. And this person, this writer, used to be a part of that union, Alex Gutentag, and could no longer stand it and withdrew from it and wrote this really helpful article. It's along the lines of what I've been telling you about what's going on in teachers' colleges at the graduate level, the schools you go to get your teacher certification. Well, this is the teachers' union having to do with elementary schools, and it's pretty incredible. You really, I think it's worthwhile pointing this out as we think about the resistance from the left, the Democrats, to school choice, and as we see the interest and thirst and desire for more homeschooling. Oakland, California. Teachers union ended a two-week strike, the union's third strike in five years. The district offered a substantial salary increase for teachers before the strike even began. It wasn't about the money. It wasn't about the money. But negotiations remained deadlocked for days over the union's, Oakland Education Association's, common good proposals. Common good proposals. It wasn't about the money. Common good proposals, like any good Marxist, it wasn't about the money. It was about the ideology. Those proposals included drought-resistant shrubs, a climate justice day, reparations for black students, and converting unused school and office buildings into housing for homeless kids and their families. Okay? That's what the teachers in Oakland were striking for. Not money. Reparations for black students, drought-resistant shrubs, and a climate justice day, as well as converting unused office and school buildings into housing for homeless kids and their families. This is not a rogue branch of the teachers' union, the Oakland Education Association. It's, as I say, the affiliate of the National Education Association, the largest labor union in the United States, which explicitly tells teachers to bargain for these common good proposals, advising union branches that, quote, when we expand the continuum of bargaining, we build power and go on the offense in order to fight for social and racial justice, close quote. Nowhere there do you hear anything about teaching the students. Nowhere do you hear anything about raising scores. Nowhere do you hear anything about quality of teaching. In other words, the schools, like the New York Times and like CNN, is nothing more than an adjunct of the political party named the Democratic Party and the ideology named Marxism. That's what the schools are now in California. 602-508-0960. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, 602-508-0960. That would be a Wrecking Crew production.
Yes,
wouldn't it?
It would.
Is that where you're signaling me?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, everything by the Monkees, I think, right? I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, because they didn't really do their own. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. they needed a big backup. Yeah, right. They became musicians later, sort of. Well, Nesmith was, I think, wasn't Nesmith a legitimate musician? He had written some stuff.
Didn't it all start out because of the television program?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They wanted something that kind of was an Americanized version of the Monkees, if I'm not mistaken. And then they got to believing their own press and their own success so much so that they got into a fight with the producers, if I'm not mistaken, about wanting creative control of their own records.
Oh, that I didn't know.
Yeah, 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 yeah. There's some...
Essentially, it's the actor saying he wants to be the director.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And they put out some other music. I guess the suits upstairs there conceded to them, and they put out some other music, and it just wasn't that good. sometimes let the heart surgeons be the heart surgeons, you know. But do you guys remember this? This is interesting. You obviously remember who Deborah Birx was. She did have a book tour. She wrote a book and had a book tour. In her book, it was called Silent Invasion. It came out a year ago. It came out a year ago, and evidently conservatives didn't read it. Silent Invasion, the story of COVID, the untold story of the Trump administration, COVID-19, and preventing the next pandemic before it's too late. You know, she's one of the people responsible for the horror of what took place in this country during COVID. And you all remember Dr. Birx. But apparently, not a lot of conservatives bought it. Why would they? We had heard enough from her. But one did. And a guy named, or I guess he's a conservative, a guy named Kevin Bass. I don't know him. PhD. But he was picked up by John Hinderacher over at the Powerline. He was going through the book. Listen to what John Hinderacher writes. Remember when government officials told us that we needed just a brief shutdown of economic and social activity to flatten the curve of COVID transmission? The theory, although few seem to remember it, was that the same number of people would eventually catch COVID. We just wouldn't catch it all at once, and thus we wouldn't overload the hospital system. In fact, 2 weeks of curve flattening turned into a year and a half of fascist control. If you think that overstates the case, consider that my own governor, John Hinderacher writing, consider that my own governor issued an order that purported to bar every resident in Minnesota from leaving his or her house without the governor's permission. The transition from curve flattening to outright fascism was so smooth that one always suspected it was planned from the beginning. And sure enough, the appalling Dr. Deborah Birx admits it was all a lie. So they go. So this guy, Kevin Bass, PhD, is reading it. And let me read you directly from her book. Quote, on Monday and Tuesday, while sorting through the CDC data issues, we worked simultaneously to develop the flatten the curve guidance I hoped to present to the vice president at week's end. Getting buy-in on the simple mitigation measures every American could take was just the first step leading to longer and more aggressive interventions. Close quote. They lied to us. Remember when Fauci said, when Biden came in, I know this was a bugaboo of Bill's, when Fauci said, the difference between this administration and the last is we're not going to guess. He never said we're not going to lie. Deborah Birx, I'll read that sentence again. We worked simultaneously to develop the flatten the curve guidance I hope to present to the vice president at week's end. Getting buy-in on the simple mitigation measures every American could take was just the first step leading to longer and more aggressive interventions. They thought the American people was a frog, and they wanted to throw that frog into their cauldron of water. And I can think of no better real-world example of that concept of the boiling frog than what she says right there. I'll never get over this. Getting buy-in on the simple mitigation measures every American could take was just the first step to leading to longer and more aggressive interventions. The 2-week flatten, the 15-day flatten the curve, that was a lie. That was an intentional lie. Shame on them. Shame on them. I'm Seth, 602-508-0960. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Just a little gripe, if I might. I noticed two things the Dennis Prager Show has stolen from me. Requisitioned. Maybe there's no stealing within the same company. One of them was some of our bumper music that I heard today. Mel McDaniel's Baby's Got Her Blue Jeans On. That's not typical Prager rejoin music. It was for us. And Bill, wasn't it me who said we teach what should be taught when they were doing we teach what isn't taught? They've now changed it to my thing. We teach what should be taught. I use that to distinguish us from PragerU. Well, okay. It reminds me a little bit like what Bill Buckley said. David, do you know what he said when he was asked how many subscribers National Review had? You remember it vaguely? He said, together with Reader's Digest, 1,050,000.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Here's some welcome news. This is an inspired idea. This is a really good idea. Y'all know my friend Josh Hammer, who's the senior editor at large over at Newsweek. He's been on a lot, and I've been on his podcast and stuff. He's a tremendously gifted writer and scholar. This is a really inspired idea. There's all this attempt. It's an implicit chill in criticizing George Soros by claiming every time you criticize George Soros, that's a dog whistle of anti-Semitism because George Soros was born Jewish. Of course, that rule never worked when it comes to Dennis Prager or me or Sheldon Adelson when he was alive. I mean, you know, it just never works the other way. Doesn't work when you criticize Larry Elder. It's not considered to be racism. Just because you criticize someone and they happen to be of some kind of other minority, ethnic, racial, religious,
doesn't mean you're attacking them because of their minority status. It means because you're attacking them for their ideas. If anything, it's a salute that you aren't looking at their minority status and you are taking their ideas seriously enough to criticize the idea. And the person who says you're criticizing them out of bigotry is the person who is looking at them exclusively for their minority status and disregarding their idea. That's a really important point. But it's probably secondary to the point that when they criticize you for being an anti-Semite for criticizing George Soros, what they're doing is saying you shouldn't criticize George Soros. What they're doing is saying you will pay a price for criticizing George Soros. You will be called a bigot if you criticize George Soros. That's called chilling speech or prior restraint in some respects. It's nonsense, especially because George Soros doesn't even think of himself as Jewish. But anyway, what Josh Hammer did, great and inspired thing. Reading from the Washington Examiner. Today, the senior editor-at-large of Newsweek, Josh Hammer, and a current candidate for Attorney General of Missouri, Will Scharf, announced the launch of a new group called Jews Against Soros. This is how you do it, folks. This is good guerrilla, intellectual guerrilla warfare. They tweeted, quote, "There is nothing anti-Semitic about opposing George Soros and his left-wing radical agenda." On their website, they explain that the organization's purpose is twofold. First, it wants to push back on Soros' malign leftist influence on American politics. The website goes on to document Soros' extensive political donations and influence in arenas such as crime, border security, guns, and Israel. On each of these issues, he holds a consistently left-wing position. They note that in the 2022 midterm elections alone, he spent $128.5 million, which makes him the largest political donor in America. But second, they also want to challenge those, quote, accusing anyone who criticized Soros of being anti-Semitic, close quote. In recent months, accusations of anti-Semitism against conservatives who attacked the billionaire who happened to be Jewish have ramped up. A New York Times news piece said, quote, "The right's fixation with Mr. Soros has waxed and waned for years, but recent events have given new life to what critics have long contended is a fixation tinged with anti-Semitic bigotry." Joy Reid claimed, "Governor Ron DeSantis using the phrase Soros-backed Manhattan prosecutor means we believe that black folks in positions of power are controlled by some Jewish overseer who is pulling the strings." The New Republic ran an article, "Why the Right Can't Quit Its Anti-Semitic Attacks Against George Soros." President Joe Biden's envoy to combat anti-Semitism wrote, "It is entirely disingenuous to deny that many ad hominem attacks on Soros rely on classic anti-Semitic rhetoric. In this context, the formation of Jews Against Soros is a welcome development. With respect to its first name, it is eminently reasonable to raise awareness of Soros' political activities and advocate against them. And for those who suggest that the attacks are unwarranted because Soros is only one man, need I remind you again, he was the largest donor in America in 2022. Left-wing politicians and activists have long attacked individual conservative donors who have given in similar numbers to Republicans. We can therefore conclude that Soros is fair game as well." More important, though, the group's second aim of combating accusations of anti-Semitism against conservatives who attack Soros is extremely important. A clear double standard has emerged where leftist attacks on conservative Jewish donors are understood to be legitimate, while conservative attacks on liberal Jewish donors are met with anti-Semitic claims. This is even the case when the liberal attacks are openly about money and power. This is a really inspired idea. This is really good. I'm glad they're doing it. I'm glad they're doing it. I did a monologue on this about a year ago. And if you follow me on Twitter, you can see I sent it out to Josh Hammer today. Josh Hammer publicized it when it originally came out about a year ago, but I re-upped it today if you want to get it. I don't think we need to play it again here. You take the point. This is a hugely important thing, and I hope it'll help. Okay. You can't, if you are proclaiming yourself to be Jewish and you are criticizing George Soros, you can't really be an anti-Semite. Unless they then move on to the second level, which is to be an anti-Semitic Jew or something like they made Larry Elder into, the black face of white supremacy. Language is just nothing but soft clay in the hands of the left. They can turn it inside out. Upside down.
They can point to the rainy weather and tell you it's dry outside. This is the Orwellian. This is the Orwellian leisure domain. They play with the language. War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Slavery is freedom. Yeah, this is how men can be women. Men can give birth. This is how Target. Excuse me, not Target. This is how Johns Hopkins Medical Center can have 50 different pronouns. Pronouns we didn't even know existed until they published their guidance on them. Pronouns that the people who want to use them probably didn't even know were available to avail themselves of. It's really not putting the cart in front of the horse when it comes to this pronoun game. It's the horse pushing the cart. We'll be right back. Thinking about the economy, bank failure, stock market volatility, possible recession, inflation. Why Refi has an investment in a portfolio with a high fixed rate of return not correlated to the stock market or the Fed. A portfolio where you can turn your monthly income on or off, compound it, whatever you like, with no loss of principal if you need your money back at any time. There are no fees in this secure collateralized portfolio. Why Refi is based locally. I encourage you to stop by. They'd really like you to stop by their offices on Scottsdale Road in the 101. They're great offices. I've been there, and you won't get a sales pitch. No one's going to ask you to sign anything. They just like telling you what it is they do. They leave the selling up to me and Larry Elder and a few others. And when you meet with them, you'll see why I like and trust them so much, and you can too. Why Refi is a due diligence approved firm where you can earn up to a 10.25% rate of return. That's right, a 10.25% fixed rate of return. Check them out at investyrefi.com. That's invest, the letter Y, then refy.com, or call 888-YREFI-34. That's 888-YREFI-34. So please feel free to criticize George Soros and what he does on the merits, of course, as we would criticize anyone on the merits, just as we would want to be criticized on the merits. And if anyone calls you anti-Semitic for doing so, if anyone says you're using a dog whistle, send them to this new website, JewsAgainstSoros.com. Couldn't be more clear, JewsAgainstSoros.com. It's really an inspired idea by Josh. They're religious and traditionalist Jews. They're serious practicing Jews. This isn't some kind of fake thing, you know, made up of people who were born Jewish and claim they're speaking on behalf of Judaism. It's an interesting thing you'll find in the Jewish community, too, especially in the liberal segments of it. Just because someone proclaims they're Jewish and says, as a Jew, X, doesn't mean that it has anything to do with Judaism. It has to do with what they believe, has to do with what they think. And I think we should be aware of that whenever someone spouts off by saying as a X, ellipses, whenever they identify themselves as a woman, da-da-da-da-da, as a whatever, da-da-da-da-da. Really, I mean, what are we to make of that? What are we to think of this? I'd like to just listen to your point and take it for its merits. That's the respect I owe you and you owe me. You don't get to hide behind or get a plusage point, an additive point, because of some status you had no control over. So what do? They try and get control over it by changing themselves into women and boys when they weren't. That's one way they're doing it. I wonder if that will someday, one way or another, happen with race. I know when Rachel Dolezal tried to do it, she got fired. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.